welcome to If You've Come This Far, the podcast that my friend Sean and I do, where we get to talk to people who are trying to live good lives. I like to phrase it differently every show, just to keep you on your toes.
I appreciate that, and it feeds the uncertainty of why we're even doing why we're even doing this.
There's a lot of uncertainty.
Thanks for that.
No problem. Well, and speaking of uncertainty, there might be a little less uncertainty with this episode because for only I think the second time we're having a repeat guest,
right?
And so I'll let you tell the listener who we're going to talk to today.
Yeah, delightful. Today's episode is Ben Feller, and Ben, if people recall, we interviewed Ben back in 2022. He had a new book coming out called Big Problems, Little Problems, but Ben is former White House correspondent for the AP, chief White House correspondent for the AP, and just a wonderful, smart guy, a little obnoxious Yankee fan, which we'll handle that, or we can handle that given all his other positive qualities. We enjoy talking about him. And, you know, I think listeners will really enjoy kind of him talking about, what's happened for him over the last couple of years and some of the vulnerabilities around going to doing new work and the struggles around that and also some of the accomplishments and the ideas of his son, Sam, growing now to be, be a teenager soon and how that's changed for him as well, being a dad in a different place.
Yeah. The subject of self-awareness comes up, and I would probably list that in Ben's sort of arsenal of strength.
Yeah. He says maybe not, but yeah, it doesn't come across that way to me.
No, he's thinking a lot about a lot. That's why it was really fun to go back and just to say, hey, how are things going? And to hear someone who is that sort of introspective and self-aware and paying attention like he does to everyone around him, him sort of like debrief us on that was really interesting.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting, the new work he's doing, the nature of the business is, Ms. Lansky and Partners is around being language strategists. And I think it's both you and I were like, okay, that's a really interesting idea and concept. And so Ben talks a bit about that. And, I encourage everybody to not only listen, but then go check this out and see kind of the work that they're doing. And, words matter.
And he certainly, that's undeniably one of his great strengths is his ability to communicate, which is, shocker, right? The guy was chief White House correspondent. So, but another great conversation with him. And I'm sure we'll have another one down the road.
I hope so. Yeah. And I think listeners are going to enjoy it.
All right, here we go. Ben Feller.
Did I find you?
You did.
There he is.
How's it going?
Good. How are you?
Good. I'm sorry. I just really busy here. Somebody was just going over the ALE standings with me, and I'm like, listen, I got to.
Oh my God. Are you kidding me? Are you really doing this?
It's painful. It's really painful. I don't even actually know what you're talking about. My focus is on Premier League and WNBA. That's what I'm focused on.
And I'm watching F1. I'm all about F1. Yeah. I didn't even know that there is still a Major League Baseball team.
I figure if John Henry's going to put all his money into Liverpool, that's what I should be focused on.
My God, we got to talk more often than every 2 years. This
right?
is that's a pretty big change. You guys are throwing F1 and WNBA. I got to get smarter. You guys need to carve out time for Get Smart, Ben, and then I'll be ready.
Oh, that's so funny. You know what, Ben? Dirty little secret here. We were going to start with the same subject, really, because we got that. Sean got that email from you, slamming the Red Sox, which I approve of, by the way.
I don't even know who plays for the Red Sox anymore. I now that I spend half my time in California, I'm digging the Dodgers. I'm a bandwagon jumper like nobody's business.
Yeah. The Dodgers, I think, are coming to Yankee Stadium for a series soon. I was thinking about taking my son to that because now there's like a glitz to both these teams. They've got superstars. Sure. They're playing well. It's a different vibe, you know? Yeah.
And that's going to be a hot ticket, though, right?
It would definitely be a hot ticket. So I still take Sam to opening day, and then we have a great time. And I think, there's 81 more games. We'll come back. And then you live here, and it's like, I got to go up there and spend the tickets. Right. I might go back again. It's fun.
So how many games have you guys? Oh, is that the only game you've been to this year?
So we go to opening day, and then. Yeah, he's about to turn 13.
Yeah.
His schedule is now packed. Mine is packed. And so it becomes kind of expendable. Well, I'm sure we'll go to at least one more. Yeah. And I've got a great story to tell you guys about the shortstop, Anthony Volpe. Do you know what the hell I'm talking about?
No, I have no idea.
All right. I'll give you the 30-second version now in case you want to get into this. But So Sam and I go every opening day. 2 years ago, we get on the train near my neighborhood in Brooklyn. And, it's always fun to see the Yankee fans as the train goes from, deep into Brooklyn all the way up into the Bronx. And this woman goes to Sam, "You guys going to the game?" We're like, "Yeah, look like we're going to the game." She's like, "Yeah." She goes, "Who's your favorite player?" And he looks at me like, "Why is this woman talking to me?" And he looks back. I go, "You can answer." He says, "Aaron Judge." And she goes, "Are you sure?" And now he looks at me like, "Who the fuck is this woman?" And she's like, "Are you sure it's not Anthony?"
He didn't use that word though, did he?
Anthony, no. And she's like, "Are you sure it's not Anthony Volpe?" Now that day, Volpe was starting, as a rookie, as the Yankees starting shortstop. And turns out this was his family.
The whole
subway car.
And
the Volpe is from Staten Island. The Volpe is from Bay Ridge. Like, they were all there. And they had signs up like, "It's Volpening Day." And they were so excited that their relative was going to start at 21 as the shortstop for the Yankees that they were like exuberant. And so we ended up talking the whole time. And, exchanging info, I ended up sending two of them copies of my children's book because they asked. We stayed in touch through the year. So then this year I said, "Are you guys going? We should meet." And I'm planning to meet them on the train. They got delayed. And that was exactly when New York had this incredibly rare earthquake.
Yes.
So that everyone's like, "What's going on?" It was a weird day. And so she's like, "Oh, you got on the wrong train." I'm like, "No, I'm on the right train." She's like, "We're on the one behind you." So we get off. We get back on. I go, "Where are you?" And we're texting underground. She's like, "We're in the middle." I'm like, "You got to do better than that. Like, it's a subway. You know, I'm still a reporter, like, in the middle." So Sam's doing the thing where he's looking at me like, "Dad, is this going to work?" And so I said, "Sam, I'm not going to do this to you the whole time. Like, we'll get off once more." So we get off and we run. We're just hopping cars. And the last time we try it, we get on and there's the Volpe family treating us like we're celebrities. They're like, "Ben, Sam," and they're giving hugs and we take pictures. And so now I have this unbelievable tradition of going to Yankee Stadium opening day with the family of the Yankee shortstop. And now we follow each other on, Instagram and texting. And so he's great now. He's got a 20 game hitting streak and he's a spark plug. And so we're just, I'm in touch with them. It's really fun.
Have you guys met him yet?
I've not met him. And I'm being really, hands off about that.
Yeah.
I think at the right time, I mean, obviously I'd love to go to Christmas dinner at the Volpe's with 97 Italians. I'm like, "Come eat."
And Uncle Ben.
I didn't realize. So he's a New Yorker who's. I hope he was a Yankees fan growing up and not a Mets fan.
He was. Volpe, when he was a kid, met Jeter.
Yeah.
Somehow.
Yeah.
When he was really little. And so now, I think their family is from, they've got Jersey folks and Staten Island folks and Brooklyn folks. It's a whole thing. And they're funny because now they feel like they know me. So they spend half the ride bitching about how the other side of the Volpe family gets like the tickets and the bobbleheads and they have to pay for everything. And they're like, "Can you fucking believe this?" And I'm like, what is happening? And people are looking at us like, "Are you famous?" I'm like, "No, I'm just."
Yeah.
So Anyway, it's so great to talk to you guys.
It's so good to talk to you. I mean, is there a more kind of cherished position in baseball?
Seriously.
Than the shortstop of the Yankees, right? I mean, yeah. Just crazy.
Yeah, and he won the Gold Glove, which I didn't really see. I didn't realize he had played that well defensively, but he won the Gold Glove as a rookie. Now he's hitting well, you know, at the top of the lineup. And I think he's 22. So
I just want to say this though. When I got your email abusing me in your ask to in your desire to come talk with us again, I'm not sure that's always the best way.
But tasteful, right?
Tasteful. It worked. I think Judge was, as I said, was batting under his weight. I think I sparked him on with that. I manifested for him to go crazy.
Oh my God, what a month he had. Like I always knock on wood because these big guys, they always get hurt. Yeah. You know, but for the first time through 2 months, they're all playing.
Yeah.
And so it's
Stanton's
pretty cool.
Even playing again. Holy shit.
Stanton's playing and Soto is a 25-year-old menace.
Phenom.
Yeah. So
part of your clan must be Phillies fans though, right?
No, so you'd think so, but where I grew up in central Pennsylvania, where Penn State is, it's 3.5 hours from Pittsburgh, 3.5 hours from Philly. Mm. So it's kind of like a Penn State cult thing. And then the baseball fandom is sort of split. I mean, there's not that many Pirates fans anymore. There was when I was growing up in the 70s. There were a lot. Yeah.
It's like single digits now. I think, right?
There's like four. But you don't get like a big Philly vibe in State College. It's just, it's so far removed from everything else.
So you said something that I don't want to lose track of. So you said, with your schedule and Sam's schedule, I think you use the word the games become expendable. It's kind of sad. I assume we're going to talk a little bit about Sam now, getting ready to be a teenager and, you want to talk about that? How those outings, which were so special. I mean, we talked about them in our last conversation.
I want to make sure I'm clear on that. Like the tradition of going with him opening day is the opposite of expendable.
Yeah.
Okay. It's essential and we build around it and everybody knows it. I'm like, I'm taking that day off.
Yeah.
And then if they make the playoffs, like I'll go to that. I'd love to take him, of course, to his first World Series. I've never been to World Series, but I just mean like the Tuesday night in June.
Yeah.
You know, he's got, he plays two sports. We don't, we live it's not that convenient to go. Mm-hmm. 200 blocks. And so living in New York, there's so much to do. It's like, oh, we could go to a game. We could not go to a game. I don't mean to be, it's like we've lost the opportunity.
Yeah.
But it is a big thing still to go to a Yankee game.
Yeah.
If we had like lazy weekends, I'd be like, hey, that they're, they're playing the Orioles. I'll grab two and let's go. Life is just so full that now feel, maybe this is kind of where you're going. It feels like a little bit of work.
Yeah,
to go. So we've moved it more to sort of like a special occasion, but we still have a blast when we go. And and actually, before we start, when I was chatting with you guys right about this time 2 years ago, the book was launching and I was about to start this job. And I don't know when you guys were kids, if you ever went on those water rides, like the flumes and the cabins,
log ride.
And that's what's happened to me since I've last seen you. I've just been so immersed in this, mostly in this job and a bunch of stuff with Sam, that it kind of got away from me. Like I'm usually pretty good, especially when you're nice enough to have me on of just checking in with you. How's it going? What's it look like? And it's been intense. It has been intense. And so I've now at the 2 year mark kind of going back up a bit. But it's interesting. I'm in my, early 50s and I made a transition from one place to another. And it was to expand the baseball metaphor. It was a little bit like, hey, you play center field. You've established yourself as a really good center fielder. You want to go to a different team that's kind of more fits with you are, do that. And it wasn't that. It was like, no, this is a different sport. It's a different firm, culture, contracting, business, clients, and kind of humbling to, not that my ego, it was like, wow, they didn't know really what to do to onboard me as a coming in at the very top. They'd never done that before. So there was a lot of like in retrospect kind of reaching and now I've got it and I'm kind of grinding away, but you know, it's just, it's another life chapter of like, you're always, for me, it's never smooth. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so I'm like, all right, so I've got limited time, you know, every weekend I feel like I'm behind. I'm like, all right, well, shit, I lost my groove a little bit with some people I'd started to meet, including you two. So I really did feel a little bit bad about that. So thanks for my reintroduction with an insult and an apology.
It was appropriate.
I think about this stuff a lot. Like, what do you, you know, highest and best use of your time. And like, try to think that way all the time because do you live by your schedule or do you drive your schedule? You know, and I still wrestle with this stuff. Anyway, I just wanted you to know that.
Oh, well, I think we all do. I mean, not sure what job I was in when we talked last. I think since then I left and joined a group called New Schools Venture Fund.
Yeah, I'd love to hear about that, by the way.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, it's just funny. Like, you go through your career and, of course, I think people, most people, but certainly people of our personality types are like, want to do something bigger, something more impactful. And then you get there, you're like, oh, actually, that last job, I was in a groove. It was nice to feel in control. And suddenly, you know, for like a year and a half, it's like things are, don't feel in control. And no one likes that. So it's, I think it's completely normal. I'm curious how long it took you to get the reins back in your hands.
Yeah, only last few months. You know, I was invited to speak at a conference in Miami in February in front of a group of Broadway producers. When I gave that speech about, and I'm like, okay, this is about how to make audiences care. And I did it in three chapters, you know, covering presidents and politics, like how did I do that job and how did I make my audiences understand what was going on in the world. In business, I gave a case study of the work that we do here at Mislansky about language and how we, when we shifted language from one thing to another, how much it changed behavior and attitudes. And then in life, I told the story about big problems, little problems. And all through that, there was this lesson of like, the motto of our firm is, it's not what you say, it's what they hear. And like, look what happens when you change your mindset about starting from your audience's perspective, not yours. And I said to you guys as Broadway producers, you have these amazing shows and you captivate your audiences when they're in the room, but it's all of these people outside who don't get to come to a place like this. They're not going to see the previews I am. And so how do you get them in? I'm like, well, if you're focused on your Tony Awards and, you know, all this stuff, it's like, and people don't know what the shows are about. There's so many of them. They don't live here. Like, you've got all these obstacles. What are you doing to pull them in? Mm-hmm. And once I gave that speech and, you know, nobody at my firm, they were kind of aware I was doing it. They never saw the presentation. When I came back, I took like a red eye back because we were doing our performance reviews right away. I went right into that. They didn't ask me how it went. I'm like, okay, so I'm really like, I'm kind of continue just like I was as a White House correspondent here. Like, you got to keep pushing and be yourself. And then good things will happen around. And so now I've signed Disney for a project on the future of The Lion King. Like the one of the most successful shows in the history of Broadway. And out of that speech, a lot of things have happened between them and then, but they're like, you guys do a thing that we need. And, you know, we want to figure out the language of our future. And so now we're creating this experiment with Broadway and they're like, okay, so Ben is doing his thing now. And that's how, you know, Chris, that's an example of when I'm like, all right, that was me. I was me capturing my experiences, not trying to be a master of this place, but knowing enough about this place and infusing me. And I should have done that earlier, but you know, you come into a new place. I wanted to learn the culture. I wanted to learn our process and you can't be a master of everything. You got to pick.
Well, Sean and I were talking before you came on, Ben, and we both expressed curiosity around Mislansky and language strategy. I wonder if you could sort of just give us, these two dummies that you're on the call with, a little bit of a primer. And Sean,
highly intelligent person, right?
Yeah, I'm not gonna guess who's who on that, by the way.
Thank you.
I love you. I'm loving your shirt, Sean. Backwards. I did that. I did Backroads one time last summer with Sam. I took him to Montana and Wyoming, and life changer for him.
Yeah,
he saw like mountains on a TV show, Modern Family. I'm like, is that real? Does that exist? I'm like, that's in our country, man. Yeah. We got to get you out of the East Coast. Think about it this way. You know, what I used to do when I left journalism, went into business, was help companies, nonprofits, leaders figure out their best story. How do you say what you're trying to say in a way that matters to your audiences? But I did it in a firm that did a lot of things, a lot of different things, lobbying, you know, public relations, all that. And I was always focused on being a senior counselor to clients and what story are you trying to tell? What questions are you asking to get there? And then I would figure out their best story and I'd write it for them. The place I'm at now, instead of that being one thing that we do, it's the center of what we do. It's we are in charge of finding out the language that makes your audiences listen to what you're saying, which is hard, care about it, which is also hard, and then act, do something with it, sign up, register, vote, buy, you know, whatever they're trying to do. And so that's the definition of language strategy. It's not just writing in words, but neither is it just counsel business strategy. It's both. It's the language that that informs how your audiences will pay attention and change behavior. And so, you know, we typically start with talking to audiences that matter to you, and we work with clients to figure out who they are. We do that work, either focus groups or surveys or both. And then instead of giving you data, we show you what the data showed, take you on a journey, but then we convert it into really plain spoken language. Say this, don't say this, here's why. And depending on the format you need it in, do you need it? You know, we usually do kind of like a messaging architecture, but you might need a one pager, you might need proof points. It depends on what you're going through. And then you're off and running. You use that, and instead of going into marketing or campaigning or digital media and you're kind of guessing, you're like, hey, this, we like this. We've decided we like this. Now you're using language that your audience has said, this would work with us. So it's informed. And so sometimes folks will say, oh, we already have a marketing firm. We already have a PR firm. Like, we don't do PR. If you want to use this to pitch reporters or, you know, to put up a billboard in Times Square, that's great. It can inform it. But it's really about getting the language right. Because our viewpoint is language is how the world is run. You know, language is how you communicate with your customers, with your families, you know, with the person you're trying to figure out when the next train is. Like, everybody needs clarity in their communications. And so often when we get pulled in, it's because somebody at a company says, you know what, we're just stuck. We're stuck. We're talking to ourselves. We need somebody else. Can you help us? And so, you know, we have a firm of about 70 people. Most of them are practitioners, you know, some very earlier in their career, kind of mid-career, and they're doing the work, all the different pieces of that process I talked about. If we're talking to audiences, like finding the audiences, doing the screeners so we find the right people, running the interviews, I'm trying to stay at 30,000 feet and say, you know, what are the key points of this story and keep the client engaged, keep my team focused on the right thing. And also spend a lot of my time finding the next client, you know, doing a lot of this. And so I'm finding for me, one good way to do that is just to get in front of a bunch of people. So I'm doing a lot of speaking, and usually, you know, I walk them through how language works in different parts of life. And then people see different things in that. They're like, oh, can you come speak to our team? Oh, we don't have a brand problem, but we're launching a new thing over here. Do you guys do that too? And it's so flexible. You know, it applies to your overall reputation. If you're in a tough moment, if you've got a leadership change, if you're expanding in a new market, like all of these things are, what the hell are we trying to say? And so that's what it is. And I, you know, it fuses a lot of what I've done in my career, because ultimately it comes back to, like, are you asking the right questions? Are you saying it in a way that people care? And are you getting the hell out of your own way? Putting your ego aside and your language aside and just saying it as straightforwardly as you can.
So two things occur to me. First of all, is the language that you're working on with these entities, both external and internal. And then secondly, I find myself sometimes, you know, the phrase will come up, words matter. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I think I'm being too picky, or, you know, so what? I'll just use this word. Why am I thinking so hard about the right word? That matters, though, is what you're saying, right? I mean, it's important to find the right word.
Yeah, it's so important. And I think sometimes if you don't live in words and language every day, you think, okay, this is semantics. This is actually part of the what we talk about with our clients, and say, there's probably part of you right now have said, like, this is just semantics. These are language people. And then we put up examples on the left side and the right side, you know, of, kids in cages, or like security enforcement, like which is, it's the same thing, depending upon where you go, like how you frame the argument matters. This is how people think. And so you got to be careful, not in a pedantic way, you know, like arguing over the merits of saying, are you angry or are you mad? But in the language of like, okay, pick the thing that means what you want to say, but also matters. And that's hard. That's hard to do, because a lot of people aren't skilled at this, or they don't have the time to do it, because they're running the business, or they don't have the ability to check with audiences. And so it matters a lot. And yes, it's internal and external.
Yeah.
What we do is we talk to our client and walk them through the journey, so that they don't think it's Ms. Lansky coming in with the answer. Mm-hmm. It's Ms. Lansky uncovering the answer that they have, right? Mm-hmm. It's your story, and it's your audience's story. We're pulling it together for you. And then sometimes they actually hire us just for internal. Mm-hmm. Like they're fine with their customers. They're snarled internally.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, with their own, they've got six people describing their company six different ways.
Yeah.
And so how do they get aligned? And sometimes it's both.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you're nearly 2 years into this gig. It sounds like you're getting your groove. Sam is almost a teenager. Like where are you at now? Because you talked about sort of like a couple years of a little bit of struggling, but on a scale from 1 to 10, being 10, I'm in complete control. Everything's going like I want it to go. Where are we at?
I'd say this, the number is rising. That's how I look at it, right?
That's great.
That's how I think the best way to answer it. When I spoke to both of you gents last, I had launched a book and was about to start this new job. And I remember walking down my street in Brooklyn, and a close friend of mine saw me, and he's like, hey, how's the job hunt going? Have you found a job? And I kind of looked at him quizzically, and he's like, what's wrong? I said, no, it's just not how I would say it. He's like, what do you mean? Like, what's wrong with the question? I said, well, I'm not looking for a job. I had a job. I'm deciding what I want to do next. He's like, oh, well, that's like next. That's it. And I obviously I've spent a lot of time thinking about this, but that framing is self-empowerment. And it's like, mm-hmm. I'm on a journey here. I'm trying to maximize what I do well, maximize my time and obviously my money, but also I put more focus on the pursuit of happiness.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so to your question, Chris, like the pursuit is ongoing. It's always ongoing, and it's not linear. I wish it was. I've been at this now for 31 years, and mm-hmm. you think I'd be good at it by now. And I am at the work, but the pursuit is always like, okay, the pressure's changed, that everybody gets tired more easily. Sam's getting older. And so I'm like always trying to take stock of how am I doing? And right now, I think it's going well, but I'm still on the pursuit.
Well, I'm going to ask both of you, since because I know Chris, and as he made the job change, that you know there were some I'll just say surprises, struggles, what have you. Both of you are pretty self-aware. Did you guys know as you went through this that holy shit, this is not what I expected? A little tough, testing me, but that's. All good to a particular end, that, and you don't necessarily have an end in mind, but that this is growth. This is how it's meant to be. And I can persevere and be better for the struggle.
Well, I'll go first. And Chris, I'd love to hear your answer to that. I'm not that self-aware.
Well, that's self-awareness right there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I mean, look, I started this position in the summer of 2022. And when I look back, that's the virtue of looking back. It's like, oh, that first six months, I would have done it differently. Mm. How I would have done it differently is kind of inside baseball and not that probably interesting to your audience, but I'm like, oh, if I would have known then what I know now, I would have said, like, don't worry about this. Worry about this. Mm. And I wish I had somebody, frankly, who'd said, like, there's 72 things to know. Really, five matter the most. Mm-hmm. But when you don't know that and you don't have that filter, you worry about 72 things.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, you could say perseverance, growth. The fact is, it just didn't feel that good because I was, you know, kind of grabbing jello. I'm sure when I look back at that first 6 months, I know that I got things done then that are helping the whole company now. But at the time, it felt like I got to Christmas. I'm like, how did that go? It doesn't feel like I thought it was going to feel. Mm. And it's not that I'm not getting it. It's just like, what am I trying to get? And so then I had to come out of that Christmas break. I'm like, all right, look, if this is going to work, I need to just pick some things. I'm going to stop doing that. I'm not going to worry about that. I'm going to do this. And he's like, oh, that sounds great. Very self-aware. Well, no, the things I stopped worrying about, there are still people that want me to worry about those things. And I'm mm-hmm. like, I can't. But over here, I'm going to take on things that you guys don't even know about. I'm going to be me and go this way. And there's probably some people quietly are saying, like, Ben still never, you know, he never invested in X or he hasn't mastered that. I'm like, I'm not going to try to master everything this company does, because if we've been around for 20 years and what I need to do is flip it and say, here's what I do and draft into what we do, not the other way around. So that was my moment of inflection. I wish somebody had said, hey, just don't worry so much. And I've never found that person. The only person that says that to me is me professionally. Personally, I've got friends and family be like, don't worry about it. But in a job setting, I think every place I've worked and every boss I've had, the reason that they don't is because they want you to worry. they want, you know what I mean? They don't want you to be unhappy, but they want you, like, no, how about this? How about this? And the more, the busier you get in a profession, the more you have to just be your own boss and say, like, I'm going to focus on the right things. That's the path I've been on. John, what about you, Chris?
Well, I mean, it's interesting. Like, I agree with you. There is that tendency to value worrying a little bit, right? It's like accountability and drive, you know. And I'm not sure that it's good for organizations to want that. But I would say largely the same thing. But I think, you know, you get older, or I should make an I statement. I get older and I think, oh, I learned my lessons. I won't be fooled again, in the words of Roger Daltrey. And then I go back to thinking it's like my Peloton strength trainings, where they're talking about, what is it, hypertrophy, where, you know, the growth requires some muscle damage. And so, you know, I think, okay, well, this is not all bad, right? I'm actually growing in the process. Something that helped me in my new gig and that I've tried to take into life, and Sean's probably heard me say this a million times, but is this notion of essentialism, which is basically what you were saying. It's like, you know, not everything can be essential. Well, there it is. Oh my God, that's hilarious.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. This is why I need to talk to you guys more than 2 months. This is always like one arm's length away. Yeah.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Chris.
You saw the book, right, Sean? You can
see
it.
Yes, I did. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Uh-huh. But to tie it back, I mean, during this process, I have to ask, were you ever saying, oh, big problem, little problem? I mean, you kind of wrote a book on big problems, little problems. I know it was about, you know, it was a children's book. Did you go through that at all?
Yeah, I did. Well, I've got a two-part answer for you on that. Okay. The first is, yeah, I have. And there were a couple times that I'm like, look, I remember, I maybe told you guys the story last time, but I remember, you know, on a surprise secret trip to Afghanistan with President Obama, and things just went completely sideways. The story leaked. They had us already on the ground. We weren't. They had us in the wrong city in Afghanistan. It was a deeply dangerous position. And, you know, I had to make a gut call just to say, go with the story, you know, the correct story, even though the embargo hadn't lifted, but the embargo had been broken. And I just remember, you know, that was like life and death for us and the press corps and the president, and having to make that decision on behalf of the whole worldwide news organization. Mm-hmm. So when I remember how I handled that, you know, almost what, 12, 15 years ago. Then it puts in perspective, like, okay, I got this. Mm-hmm. You know, like, let's not overdo this. This is might be uncomfortable, you're wondering, but like, you've been here before. So yes, I've done a version of Big Problems, Little Problems. It's hard.
Yeah.
But it is. And the other thing is, I spent the day at my son's school studying the presidency. And so they had me in as a guest speaker at four sections of the class. So I was there all day and it went really well. I loved it. And then the moment it ended, you know, and the teacher was like, I can't believe these kids haven't been this riveted all year. And Sam came up to me and he said, so, okay. And whenever he says some, okay, it's like something bad just happened. He lost his AirPods.
Oh,
and I'm like, all right, well, I looked at him like, Sam, immediately there's another problem. Like the second and he's like, I know it's terrible timing. And he started to get upset. I go, don't worry. Like, let's solve it. You know?
Yeah.
Let's solve it. And we ended up finding him, a crazy story of how we found him. But it's like, you're always problem. Mm-hmm. If I just spent the whole day teaching your classmates about the virtue of big problems, little problems, and you say I lost, but I can't get frustrated about this because I would have liked maybe 2 minutes of a break, but like, we don't get to decide when the problems happen.
That's right.
And then, you know, we solved it. And so, yeah, I've had to do it. I mean, what about you, Sean? Do you still have these moments, you know, of how's it going and what do I do about it?
Sure. Absolutely. I've found, this is maybe a little, there's been some situations recently where I'm thinking about, okay, well, you know, this is, maybe going to be a little bit difficult, or I'm going to try this. I may be risking some things. I mean, particularly as it relates to work that we're doing at Men Living, and the thought comes to me, well, I'm going to be dead someday. So let's just do this.
Yeah.
And see, honestly, and kind of see, I mean, that's the ultimate kind of view for me is, am I going to let something, you know, get in the way because somebody might think it's not great or it didn't work, or it more about I'm enjoying the journey, which is maybe an overused word sometimes, but I'm enjoying the activity, the work, what have you. And if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. I'm going to be dead someday. Nobody's really going to remember it anyways.
You know, that's that notion.
And it's funny. That's recurring. It's been recurring to me a lot lately. Yeah.
Interesting. Because you've heard me talk about my growing sensitivity to mortality, right, Sean? Yeah. Nothing sort of like hones our perspective on what's important and what's a large caliber problem and a small caliber problem than the notion that we're not going to be here forever. Hey, listeners. If you enjoy our show, please consider following us or sharing the show with a friend. And I want to take a quick second to shout out our sponsor, Half Acre Beer Company, from their iconic Daisy Cutter Pale Ale to the refreshing Bodum IPA. All of the beers that these guys are making are a testament to quality and to their passion for brewing. So cheers to Half Acre Beer Company for supporting if you've come this far and for brewing great beers. And now let's get back to the show.
By the way, while I'm with you guys, I think it ties into this and Men Living and all the things you guys have talked about. I'd love to run something by you that has been paramount for me, and I'd love to get your opinion. I'm going to sort of test it out with you, if you don't mind. It's about how dads are viewed. And specifically, it comes up to me during Father's Day season. And here's what I mean. For all my adult life, you know, when I've gone into the greeting card section, some people still buy cards, you know, and Father's Day, I got to get a Father's Day card, right? The Father's Day cards represent, whether they're the funny ones, the silly ones, the sappy ones, or the ones where you just, you know, write your own message, they represent an image of dads. And it's been the same for, you know, 30 years. Here's how it's represented. This is the first one I saw, and I just did this as a test case, and man, did my theory come true. There's a dad and a son on the front, and it says, hey, Brian, am I a good dad? And he's like, my name's David. You know? And all of them are like, hey, dads who are on the couch and can't find the remote. Dads, you know, barbecue and they burn it, like golf, fishing. And I'm like, okay, even if you account for the fact that the joke's on us, you know, the dad joke's on us, as I put it, it's like, you know what's missing from all of these? And I think from broader conversation, the dad with the kids, the thing that makes us dads are the kids and the time with the kids. And so I've been testing this theory. I'm like, you know, dads are planners, dads are problem solvers, dads are empathetic. They solve the kid when they're crying. And more and more, and this is why this is anecdotal, not proven, I wanted to run it by you. I just had this conversation with friends last night. They're like, no, you're that way. Most dads don't go play with their kids. Most dads are on the couch. Most dads only help when they're asked. And I'm like, that can't be true. And like, no, you know, a lot of dads are not that present and involved. And so I'm like, well, look, if that's accurate, that bothers me. Mm-hmm. And if it's inaccurate, it bothers me, because that's the reputation we're getting. And I'd like to get out this narrative. Like, you know, there's a whole group of us who are so invested in the daily doing of being dads because we love it and because we have to, that when I pick up cards of absentee stupid dads who only want to care about going from football season to baseball season on the couch, I'm like, you have us wrong. And I'd love to get your reaction.
Man, that's such a good question, because there is that sort of air of cynicism almost. And it takes me back to something you said about your firm now, where it's like, it's not what you say, it's what they hear. And in this case, maybe it's not even what you do as a dad, but what your kids remember you having done as a dad. But I think that gets poisoned by these greeting cards and this notion, which is probably unfair. I don't know what the data say either, but I tend to side with you. I think that that there are more good dads out there than what the hype would have you believe. Sean, what do you think?
Well, I think, first of all, I mean, I've seen some studies, you look at the data, the media continues, not only is it greeting cards, but the media continues to put forth the bumbling dad who doesn't know shit, who's not engaged, and on and on. And I think what I see are more and more men that are stepping up that are actually starting organizations. Like, we had Paul Sullivan on. He used to be columnist for the New York Times, who started an organization called the Company of Dads, which is really focused on lead dads who actually are the man who's, if you will, running the house. That's probably talk about specific language. That's probably all bad language that I just used there, but are definitely engaged in the process. And so I think there's more and more men that are bringing spotlight to combat that media perspective on dads. And the other thing that I'll just add is, I think men are conditioned from boys to not be as emotional and engaged and supportive and focused on child rearing as we should be, because, you know, for me, it takes on this aspect of being more emotional and engaged, which we're taught not to be that way. And love is a part of that process. And if it's not about sex, then what kind of love is there? So I think, talking about it, Ben, I mean, really being focused on having this conversation and trying to change the paradigm a little bit about not only men and who we are, but also as it relates to our children, is really important.
I appreciate both of what you said a lot, and I'm hopeful that conversations like this help do that. You know, because I believe strongly, when I wrote the book, it was a passion project, and it was about how to help kids, whether you're a father, a mother, or another, you know, family member or guardian. How do you help kids understand how to make big problems little through the way you explain to them, breathe with them, talk with them, and then how kids can do it for us as well. Since that time, I still feel strongly about all that, but also I'm kind of like, you know, I'm getting a little bit tired of this idea that that's just not things that dads do. And I think that we have to change the paradigm. And again, as I said, if people see that and say, like, that's great, but no dad I know does that. Factually, no dad. And if they say that, I had this conversation last night, I'm like, wow, then they should be. Time to step up. But if they do, let's give them credit. I don't mean extra credit. I think this is normal credit.
Yeah.
It's just parenting. But if you're going to have a day, just like you have Mother's Day, if you're going to have Father's Day, then let's at least honor what the hell they're doing. Because those that image is not what we're doing. We're doing a lot more than that.
So I'm getting a sense that this kind of feels like a focus group for the next book pitch. I don't it's got a feel for that. I don't know if you're
it's a great idea.
If you're thinking about the next book, but it might be a good one.
That's I hadn't thought about it that way. But yeah, there's something there.
Are you thinking at all about the next book? Or
yeah, I have. You know, the beauty about the first one was it came up organically.
Mm-hmm.
And that's often how the best of life happens. It's like, here's the thing I did. And then you're like, wow, what came of it? So yeah, I have another one in me and I don't know the format of it. It could be that, you know, I spent a lot of time still talking about my background and covering politics and how it informs my life now. And I get asked a lot about this election year. And so there's also something, you know, in there that might be a novel, but you know, look, I got to be accountable to myself. When you talked about giving me credit for self-awareness, I also have a sense of mortality. Yeah. I'm busy as hell. I don't put enough time into, you know, proper sleep and exercise and something I'm worried about. So taking on a book, I've talked to some people who are friends of mine who are authors, and they've shown me their book proposal process for that kind of thing is different than the one that I did for a children's book. It's massively challenging and difficult and time consuming. And so then the same idea of like, oh, what can I do? Turns into what do I have to do? And that's really the struggle of when you asked Chris earlier about how it's going. It's like those two tensions. What do I want to do versus what I have to do? And somewhere in that struggle, that second book hasn't happened. But there's an opportunity there where I might say, like, you know what, I'm going to make it a goal. And maybe, you know, carve out a day, a week or something. And that's what it would take. It's not going to happen. That's what it's not going to happen organically. I'm going to have to discipline, commit to it, pick an idea, investigate it, write it. And to your point, Sean, let it fly.
Yeah.
Just let it fly.
Yeah. Talking about pitching, and I'm curious about the companies that you pitch your services to.
Mm-hmm.
How many get it? How many are like, yeah, language matters? And let's say then they're not coming to you. You're going to them. Language matters versus language doesn't matter. It's all of, you know, it's whatever. It's something else. I mean, it's all about the ad or it's all about the product or how many get it?
A lot of them get it, but in order to get it, the burden is on us to show it. It's not intuitive. That's why, you know, when I started and I joined a firm that does language strategy for a living, I was like, I don't know why we lead with that. People don't know what the term means.
Yeah,
so so I ran a project here internally, which changed now how we talk about ourselves. And we don't put language strategy first, at least when I talk about it. It's about, you know, language shapes how business is done and the world is run. And it's not what you say that matters. It's what they hear. When you can find the language that makes people listen, care, and act, that's how you win. And people get that. They're like, yes, we like that. We need that. Okay. Now then, that's what we do. We find that language. And the way that we do it, we walk through a process and we call it language strategy. So we flipped the storytelling for us. Typically in a group setting, we'll walk through some examples. To give you guys a quick example, we've done a lot of work over the last 18 months on the field of ESG, the umbrella term for how companies do good in the world, their people, their accountability, what they're doing to help society, and environmental, social governance, right? That term, even when you say it out, it's jargon. When you shrink it to an acronym, people have no idea what you mean. So we walk people through it, and either they're in this space or they run companies and they're like, oh my gosh, we do the same thing. Okay, great. This is kind of awareness. We found that, you know, only one out of 10 voters really understand the term. We ask people, what does it stand for? At least a few of them said eggs, sausage, and grits. That's not a good thing because that's not what ESG is. And so we walk through, like, this is what they're hearing. This is what they're hearing. It's coming across as forced morality. Mm-hmm. Companies saying, you know, but then they're like, well, wait a minute. We're out here with these commitments to reduce our carbon footprint, right? To be accountable on our employees' rights. Now we're getting hammered for it as being woke. So what do we do? Do we go back on our word? Here's what we'll do. We'll just take the language off the website. We'll quietly do it. Like, all these are bad outcomes. Like, so our proposition is that we found the same goals and language and values work if you just change how it's framed. So we found what voters want is this idea of responsibility. So when you change the frame to responsible business, but keep everything else the same, instead of just getting Democratic support at like 2/3, you get Republican, independent, and Democratic support. And the jump was a massive, like 30 points for the skeptics, you know. So now everybody's a supporter, and the Democrats who were already there are way up. And when you show the difference between those two slides, the audiences go, aha, right? Like, oh my gosh. And they're like, that's it? You just changed those two words? I'm like, no, we did a lot of research to understand. And then what comes after those two words? And it filters down to everything else you're talking about. You know, stop saying multi-stakeholder engagement. Mm-hmm. Saying we talk to the people who, you know, who matter to us. And all of these different, you know, changes, which aren't semantics. And you start fundamentally talking about the thing you're doing differently. And all of a sudden you're like, yeah, I could support that, because you're not telling me what to do. Mm-hmm. You're a company that's making money, which I appreciate, and you're being responsible, which I appreciate, and you're staying the hell out of politics.
Yeah.
Just do the right thing and make money and we're all happy. And so in that sense, Sean, people get it when they see it, and they start, and that's usually what I do is that if giving that kind of presentation, I pull the camera way back and say, now think about what I said at the beginning, language shapes how business is done. This affects so many things you're doing. If you're, you know, an airline, you're trying to break into a new market or deposition yourself from the competition, maybe you don't have an ESG problem.
Yeah.
But you got something about customer service, and you're like, oh, these guys are at the center. And so it's on us to explain it. But then when you start showing case studies and giving examples, it kind of clicks. And that's what we're looking for.
And do you work in conjunction with brand development or advertisers as well? I mean, you're kind of a consultant to them, because I'm just thinking about words. You're talking about it. And one that clicked with me recently, I don't know if you guys have seen the new Lilly commercials, Eli Lilly. It's Lilly, the medicine company. And and I've just been pondering that one recently, because I think it's a really interesting tagline. So
Yeah. I mean, we do a lot of work in the pharmaceutical space.
Yeah. Okay.
And so think about the entry points of these conversations. It could be, again, at your overall brand, a division of a brand, or the launching of a product or a therapy. But what we do sits at the center of a circle. And this is how I've started to talk about it and visually show it in our presentations. So if the outside of the circle is advertising, marketing, branding, executive communications, big events, you know, your social channels, your CEO's speeches, all of that is the tactical ways in which you spend a ton of money to get the message out. The work we do is at the center, the language strategy at the center. So it does work in tandem with those things. Mm-hmm. Sometimes there's already a branding campaign underway, or they're planning to do a launch of something, and they'll say, hey, get the Maslansky folks in here. We've got like 2 months to get this right.
Yeah.
And then we'll give it to them and they'll start using it. Or we work with them to train their people. Sometimes they package it with visuals, and then they'll say, can we test? You've already tested the language. Can you test the way it looks in this visual so that we see if it works? And sometimes it manifests itself in a tagline.
Yeah.
Too. So it's all of those ways. And that's why, you know, I remember interviewing somebody who now works here, and she said, guys, it really seems like you guys have a really fascinating niche.
Yeah.
And I said, we do, but don't think about it as niche. It's expansive. Mm-hmm. You know, it applies to everything. And that's part of my job, is to show people that. Like, I'm talking to entertainment, I'm talking to sports, education. Like, don't think of us as just how you know us, is where else can this go? And that's a harder fight, because obviously it's easier to go where the groove is.
Yeah.
You know, but part of my job is to take us in different directions, and I'm trying.
That Sean, that Lilly decision is such a fascinating one. I agree with you. It's like, because pharmaceuticals became pharma, and now hardly anyone can say pharma without putting big in front of it. So everyone likes to talk about big pharma, which is all bad. And then you start to trickle into methamphetamines and, you know, all the drugs that haven't treated as well. And then the families are, so that little tweak right there was kind of genius.
Yeah. I thought it was really good. I mean, simple often is even the best, I think, if you can just be simple. Kind of like Ben's email to us in the subject line.
Exactly.
Like, right, the use of words was really powerful. Yeah.
Well, one other example that comes to mind is, that doesn't involve flipping off the Red Sox is the work we did, you know, for Starbucks, and you guys might have seen this, but the thesis was Starbucks came out with an instant version of its coffee. Yep. And it was not going well because the instant image that people had of instant coffee was the stuff that my parents had in the house growing up. Yeah. Granular, dry crap.
Yeah.
And so, you know, through our work and our research, what we found is, but if you flip it, it's Starbucks coffee in an instant. It's like, oh, yeah. Okay. I get what I want fast, anytime I want. Now that I like. And so their numbers soared. And you're like, oh, that's like some language gimmick. They flipped the order. I'm like, the amount of work that had to go into finding that discovery, that's what people have to get. And they'll see it. And again, it's like, okay, it clicks, but it's like, you know, it didn't click initially. We had to test different hypotheses and find out and reframe it. And then when you do that, you just open up everybody. You know what everybody wants? Everybody wants this pain in their shoulders to go away. They don't even realize it's there, but it's kind of like, oh, and then you find the answer like, oh, thank you.
Yeah.
Now we can do our.
Yeah. That's a really good one.
Ben, I've only got about 5 minutes left and we're not going to ask you the questions again because you've already been on the show.
We're not?
No, we're not good. Because why would we? I want to hear. No, because they likely haven't changed. Next time, when Ben comes on next time, then we'll revisit. That's the new rule. Every other.
All right.
Engagement. Okay.
This is growth.
You set the rules. The rules.
But but there was something else I wanted to cover. You talked earlier about, I want to hear a little bit more about Sam, and you said he's playing two sports. What sports is Sam playing right now?
So Sam plays baseball, and his team is headed towards the playoffs right now. Nice. And he's gotten good, and I'm really proud of him. And he's, most importantly, he's proud of himself. He sees his growth. He settled into second place. He's a good hitter. He's a good teammate. Although he had a case recently where yesterday, other pitcher, you know, these are 12, 13 year olds, threw a mean curveball, and Sam, you know, jumped out of the way and it went over for a strike. And the umpire looked at him as a teaching moment. He's like, that's called a breaking ball. And Sam looked at me baffled coming off. And I was like, but it was going to hit me. I'm like, and then it curved. that's why you're going to hear about curveballs a lot in life. That was literally a curveball. So he's still learning. And he also plays water polo, which is a really unlikely sport in the middle of New York City. But his mom, to her great credit, found this somehow during the pandemic. And we were all so housebound. And there was a way to get out of the house and go to this pool after we went through like 14 different tests every time to get cleared. And it's an actual competitive club where his team plays against other teams, you know, in Pennsylvania and New York. He's gone to some tournaments in Florida, so he's gotten the sports travel bug. Yeah. And he's in the pool a lot, and they take it really seriously.
It's a great sport. It's a hard sport.
Yeah,
very hard sport. And also, you know, between one of those two things, I'm not pressuring him, but you know, between an academic scholarship or a sports scholarship. You see how I'm thinking as a business person?
Like, that's smart. Yeah.
I was thinking the exact same thing about water polo. I'm like, oh boy, there's scholarships for water polo. If you're good at it, you know, I have to ask you guys and anybody that's listening, if they remember the first time they were in the batter's box and somebody threw a really good curveball. I was bailing. I remember. I'm like, holy shit. That was amazing. Yeah. Especially a kid. That could throw a great curveball.
I remember it exactly.
Yeah.
And I just, the unfairness of it.
Right.
It's almost like, well, if you're going to throw something that's going to go behind me and it's a strike, can you tell me?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, you don't get to tell me. I'm supposed to recognize that. Okay.
I was a catcher. At that point, had not had a pitcher when I was a kid who could throw a curveball. And then I saw it. I'm like, we need pitchers that could throw curveballs. I'm like,
But it's
you're just waiting for it to come.
But when you're that batter and you're in the batter box, the first time you experience that, you're usually facing the kid who had his growth spurt earlier than you. And so he's already intimidating because he's on a mound. He's 6 foot or 6 inches taller than you, even without the mound. And it's a scary, that's a scary moment.
Yeah.
So I love how the umpire was like, that's called a curveball.
He did. He just did that. He was kind of like, what, he saw how baffled he was. You're like, what was that? I'm like,
Well, and here we are planning Sam's going to be at UCLA playing water polo in 6 years.
I love it. You know, I tell him that I bring him up in everything I do. Of course, he saw it at his school because I was standing in front of his classmates. But I talk about it in speeches and podcasts. I don't think he knows that I've committed him to UCLA.
To make the team.
Yeah. Yeah. But I appreciate that. That's, you know. Yeah. That's aspirational thinking.
Yeah.
Wait, and he's going into what grade?
He's going into eighth grade. He's just about to finish seventh. Yeah. So
Last thought on that, man. Those high school years, or these middle school and high school years, they fly by. So
they all do. All the years fly.
They all do. Right. Yeah. You're right.
Yeah. I'm trying. I think to end where we began, it's about being present.
That's right.
It really is. I mean, he was so proud that his dad was standing in front of his classmates, and he kept saying how excited he was. And I was trying not to overdo it, but I'm like, man, if you're ever lucky enough to be a dad in his early 50s and your 12-year-old son invites you to come to class and be in front of all his friends, that's an amazing feeling. Now, we did have a deal. The deal was I cannot intentionally embarrass him. I said, I might embarrass you unintentionally lots of ways, but I will not intentionally embarrass him. So I've got great baby photos of Sam on his first birthday crawling around the Oval Office. Generally on his first birthday, I brought him to the White House and they said, come on in and meet President Obama.
Wow.
And the Giants football team was being honored that day. So he was in a Giants onesie. And so there's like some John photos near the Resolute desk. I didn't use any of that stuff in the presentation.
Wait a minute. Was that a backhanded shot that the Giants were at the White House because they beat the Patriots? Was that it hit me that way.
If it was going to be a backhanded shot, I would have had to remember which time they beat the Patriots.
Talk about stuff ending where we started. That's exactly where we started.
You brought it back, Sean. But anyway, it's just so much fun to be there, you know, and that's like, that's so to your point, Chris, about it goes really fast. He kept saying, Daddy, you're going to have to take a whole day of work off. That was his big problem. And I said, that is not a big problem. I can do that. I will make the time. It's worth
little problem, Sam.
Yeah.
Little problem. Thanks for reaching out to us again, Ben. It's been a pleasure. Let's not make this 2 years before we hang out again.
You guys have made my day. I love it. And you know, anything, thanks for having me back on. And to anybody listening, love to keep the conversation going about the pursuit of happiness and present dads and anything I can do for the two of you and the work that you're doing. Hit me up anytime.
Thank you, Ben. You're a good man.
All right, gents. Happy Father's Day. Talk soon.
Yep, same to you. Peace.
All right. Bye-bye.
This is Chris. Thanks again for joining us on this episode of If You've Come This Far.
And this is Sean. Remember to check us out, mnliving.org.